Blog Talk Radio.
Just a step, cries the sad man. Take a look down at the madman. Theater king's on. Silver wings fly beyond reason. From the flight of the seagull come the spread claws of the eagle. Only fear breaks the silence as we all kneel, pray for guidance. We'll be right back.
five freaky darlings, and welcome to Late Night Poets After Midnight Show, where you get to take a walk on the wild side. If you're into the likes of Ginsberg, Bukowski, Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, and Morrison, then you are on the right night. But please check out our other After Midnight shows. Sit in with Jeremy as he brings you the Headliners Ball on Thursday. Break on with, through with Pam on Friday. Join Aphasiana and Babbla as they teach you the fine art of being part sinner, part saint. And then every other Sunday, walk in the darkness with Stelina Arcana as they delve into it deeply. These shows are designed to chicala outside the lines with rich raw emotions tinged with colloquial language, thereby pushing the envelope to expression and opening up new avenues of thought through pen and voice. So, pull up a chair, relax, and open your minds. I'm Rex and my co-host Pam Ray, and I can't wait to get into and read your work. Hey, Pam.
Hey, Rex. What's up, pumpkin butt?
Not a thing. Just cold weather.
Yeah, well, I get that. So, I always, in this area, I just feel like it could be worse. Like, you know, we just had a little rain and some wind today. I actually got out of the house today, went for a walk with my kid. We actually, where we live right now is at the bottom of a big hill. And I never actually climbed up the hill. So today I decided to take on that adventure. And we found a really nice stick. Like Nessa's going to try to whittle it. And I said, if you know, she could carve it and make it a little smoother, sand it. And then we could, purchase like a brass knob or something to put on it. Cause it's just one of those that are like the right lot size and length, to polish up, to make a nice, walking stick.
We need a bottom for it.
A what?
A bottom.
Oh yes, that is true. A bottom too. Yes. Yes. That is a good point. That is, yeah, keep it, you know, more stable. Yeah, so that was a great walk.
You want a steel brass copper bottom piece for it so it doesn't rot.
That is a good point. Oh, don't you also, you probably want to put some sort of sealant on it too, right?
Stain it and then urethane it.
Ah, there you go. There you go. Words of wisdom. That's a good idea. I'll mention that. And actually, we do have paint, but so that might actually work. But anyways, and then by the time we got to the top of the hill, because you know it's not a small hill. I mean, it's not a mountain, but it's definitely not a small hill. By the time we got to the top, it was a beautiful view. But then by the time we got to the bottom, I of course was having a little problem with my breathing because. The allergy stuff gets to me. But anyways, so cold weather, but all in all, a pretty nice day, So I'm, of course, looking forward to delving into tonight's poetry. We got our main topic is poetry inspired by quotes from Agatha Christie. But before we get to that, we do have some carryovers. I do have one carryover from a Break On Through contest that was from Truth Chills, but I'm going to hold off on that one until I'm done with the other carryovers because I know she sometimes is interested in calling in to read her poetry. But so the carryovers that I'm going to start with is from a contest that I ran on the Bolton Strid. Have you ever heard of the Bolton Strid, Rex?
No.
Well, it's actually, in the contest, I will admit, did only get 6 entries, but they were quality entries. And I thought it was a good idea, but sometimes people don't see this thing. So the Bolton Strid is actually a section of river in England. It's a little known stream in England. And most of the stream is actually a little, it's a little wider. It's, you know, the current is very visible. But what happens is the Bolton Strid part, it narrows, and it's almost like the idea that the water got put on its side. It narrows, and so current pulls downward. And then not only does the current, but the weird thing is with the Bolton Strid, like it, you actually should watch a video on this. Like if you go on YouTube, you can find videos on it. It's very fascinating. Is the top layer of it is deceptively calm. It's narrower. The top layer is deceptively calm, but it's said to have a 100% fatality rate for people who fall in. Now, that's not necessarily true, but it does have an extremely high fatality rate because of the fact that it's narrow, it's calm on top, and people will try to jump it, fall in, and then they get pulled under. And beneath the water, not only are you getting pulled under with the currents that are going in this different downward direction, but there's a bunch of, like, you know, there's a bunch of caves that people get lost in. And the reason I'm explaining this is not only because I found it very fascinating, and I thought, wow, this would be great because people can either write about this literally or they can use it as a metaphor. You know, the idea that the Bolton Strid looks calm, but underneath is this danger that you can't escape from. Like I said, I thought literal or metaphorical, either way, but not a huge response. But responses that were definitely top-notch quality. I will go ahead and get back to where I need to be and get the first poems posted. I suppose I should check phones first. Just us two turkeys. All right. So with that, a bit of information for people and I will go ahead and post the first poem. All right, so the first poem we have is What Lurks Beneath by Stelina. And Rex, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
What Lurks Beneath by Stelina. Inviting and cool on a hot summer's morn, clear fresh waters and forest greenery. Call out, beguiling with bucolic scenery, as from a snug bed you are reluctantly torn. The pungent smell of moss infuses the air, and dewy foliage bedecks towering trees. Yet, in the murky depths, it stirs and heaves as it swoops up from its fathomless lair. What, on the surface, seems like a babbling stream, holds a sinister secret, dark and deep, constantly squirming below in a restless sleep, which manifests serenely as in a diabolical dream. Boiling and blustery, it sucks you down, rising, fiercely foaming as you flail about, and upon the ragged rocks it spits you out. Before your battered body, it seeks to drown. Beneath the tranquil, innocuous facade lie the victims of the infamous Bolton Strid, who from the lit lichen-covered stones ceaseless, carelessly slid from the throes of death, desperately clawed. End poem.
Great read there, Rex. Yeah, I actually gave this one the gold because, first of all, on a technical level, it had wonderful rhyme and flow, brilliant imagery. I like how she took this on that literal level, the description of the Bolton Strid itself, and really the imagery in this is wonderful. But I like that she almost gave the Bolton Strid this spirit, this it that she keeps referring to. You know, The pungent smell of moss infuses air and dewy foliage decks towering trees. Yet in the murky depths, it stirs and heaves as it swoops up from his fathomless lair. So it not only, you know, is literal, but it also has a bit of a kind of classic horror movie vibe, like when she puts the it, you know, in quotation marks. So you start to think about, you know, what is that? You know, is it the river coming to life, or is it something that lives in the river? Because honestly, from what I read about the description of the Strid, Bolton Strid, and I'd really like to be able to go there in person, but from the descriptions of all the caves and stuff, you could almost imagine like some sort of like water or aquatic monster living beneath there. I also really like the slight alliteration in this and these lines. Boiling and blustery, it sucks you down, writhing fiercely, foaming as you flail about. Then upon the rugged rocks, it spits you out before your battered body, it seeks to drown. And that part there, the in general, it really makes me think about the idea that the idea that nature is not just beautiful, it's also without mercy. So excellent writing, very well done.
Nice. I'll go to something different. This is writ more like a phobia, and one that haunts you when you sleep. The night's forest green, the bucolic scenery, as from a snug bed you are reluctantly torn. So dream state. And again, it swoops up from fathomless lair, that thought of which manifests a really as in a diabolical dream. I'll still roll on that, but it kind of works its note to a phobia where that fear invades your dream world, and where you risk that that angle of if you die within your dream, then you actually die within yourself. So that that note to the bottom from its rose of death, desperately clawed, it's on a double angle of fighting your way out of that morass to get back to having a breath instead of swallowing water.
I like that. I like that. I like that thought. Yeah, I definitely see that struggle, that fear of drowning, that fear of death. Phobias are so fascinating too. But yeah, I thought that was a great observation. Very cool. All right. And up next we have Still Waters Run Deep by Vamped Vixen. There are secrets in the Bolton Strid, life's claimed in her black whirlpools, men lured and lost on mossy rocks, drowned in her tiny stretch of river. Like a kelpie, her siren song sucked men down under the water wild. When hikers sought to tame and ride this shape-shifting, seductive river. Her quaint little stream seems so calm, but down below the tide won't let go, and broken bodies never get recovered, drowned in her fizzy, frothy bubbles. Her Yorkshire magic devours every soul, its bubble and bubble, toil and trouble. In her caverns, two double-deckers deep, and water's grip as strong as the grave. So know the rivers you go swimming in. Beware which slippery rocks you leap. For this fierce woman demands respect, because her power always has final say. End poem.
Great read, Dan. This works a little differently. I'd go with a mystical angle, because she hits on the idea of like a kelpie, a subtle siren song. But this walks back in time where magic seemed to hold itself a little higher. And places like this would have been revered, not just for the fresh water itself, but as a place of holy reverence, because it doesn't give up that which it takes. And the thought to caverns that are two double-deckers deep, that's a hell of a thought. Figure a double deck that's say 15 feet tall, that's 30 feet in caverns. So you got to know the millions of years it took to carve those out, so it can offer up that that suction and the note that it empties out somewhere. So there is that little extra note to water plays a large role, not just in our dreams and in the myths and legends, but the fact that water is a dire necessity for humankind as a whole.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I have to agree with you that she really delves into some of the mysticism, you know, and the mythology of it. I also thought this was a wonderful personification. I really like that she made the water this powerful feminine energy, you know, especially in those last lines. And even before that, like, you know, she mentions, you know, the shape-shifting seductive river, the subtle siren song, you know, the way that she brings wonderful imagery here, and she brings the river to life. You know, she brings the Bolton Strid to life and all its danger. And I did like how she had the little details, like with the second to last stanza. Her Yorkshire magic devours every soul, its bubbling bed with her in trouble in her caverns, two double deckers deep, and watery grip as strong as the grave. I really, you know, liked also where it said, like Kelpie, her subtle siren song sucked men down to the watery wild. You know, I think it's great the way she made the Bolton Strid into this siren, into this Kelpie, into this fierce woman that demands respect. So just an amazing write and very well done.
Nice. All right. Where do we go next?
Where do we go now? That is a good question. All right. Up next, we have Dangerous Places by S. Sharp. And go ahead, Rex.
Dangerous Places by S. Sharp. Smoke rises. The blast resonates, reverberating in my veins. People lie strewn about, impaled by the shrapnel of the moment. Shards of metal scream, tears, fears intermingle. The crowd murmurs nervously, overlooking the otherwise empty Colosseum as I approach the center inquisitively, wondering why I am here. Suddenly, a gate opens opposite of me. A quarter-ton tiger growling angrily enters the arena. The jumping point is near. The roar of the engine overwhelms. Propellers hum, wind makes talking impossible. Stepping to the door, I jump, descending, twisting and turning, ripcord pulled, looking up, my parachute has failed. Death carries a pen, etching fear into gravestones, memories pushed over in a foggy graveyard, somewhere in the recesses of the abandoned mind, imagination left to die. And Paul. All right.
Well, first of all, as always, great read there, Rex. I liked this one, and I gave it a bronze because I felt like it deserved to be in the top three because he took it in a different direction, very creative. I like that it wasn't just about the river, which a lot of times in my contests, I will tell people, you know, feel free to think outside the box. You don't have to be literal, you know, experiment. And I really feel like Scott did that. Instead of just being about the river and how dangerous that is, it becomes about all of the danger out there and how we almost have an obsession with it. You know, like he goes into war, he goes into the arena, like, you know, the second stanza with the crowd murmurs nervously overlooking the otherwise empty Colosseum. Of course, that takes you back to ancient Rome and how there was this, you know, just desire to watch these bloody games. And, you know, the skydiving, it's the idea that we seek this excitement. We seek our heads turn automatically when we go by a car crash. We want this adrenaline rush. We want to watch violence. And in the end, it leads to death. I thought this had strong imagery in it. I did like the end, how it took this twist, because, the other thought I got from it and that I put in my comment was because it says, my parachutes failed. Death carries a pen etching fear into gravestone memories pushed over in a foggy graveyard somewhere in the recess of the abandoned mind, imagination left to die. So I thought this was a layered right because I did think that it could speak on the idea of how we are oftentimes adrenaline junkies. But it also spoke on the idea that the mind that has been abandoned by the gift of imagination, which is why where those end lines come in, that idea of dealing with the writer's block. So excellent write and very well done.
I'd go with that writer's block angle. This does what dangerous places. It's a matter of, most times, it's a matter of choice. The choices one makes in the moment, like jumping out of that airplane, because you're not the one packing that parachute. Someone else is. So you take chances. And those chances, whether you're an adrenaline junkie or not, or whether you just like skydiving as that notation to like sailing or deep sea fishing or something along that lines. There is inherent danger in anything you do. It doesn't really matter. Taking that walk in the city, stepping off a curb and getting crushed by a cab, or waiting for the bus, yet the bus runs you over while you're staring at it. So I think the idea with this is death comes at you from all manner of places. But if you toil on the note of death, then you don't get to live because you're void of your imagination, because you're too much wondering about the angle of death when it comes, instead of actually taking those chances. So nicely done, Scott.
Absolutely. And I like that thought there. Yeah. Because sometimes, like you said, people are too busy worrying to really live life to the fullest. Very cool comment. All right. Let's go ahead and see what we have next. All right, The Striding by Lockdown Larks. Come to me, my dears, come challenge little Strid. Many tried over the years, few can say survive they did. Mother Earth nurtures me, helping her take control. So little of me can you see, step in, let me take your soul. Come on, show your contempt, jump, you know you want to. I promise it'll be your last attempt. I'll take you down to my darkest blue. This journey will not be so bad, meeting millennia of souls yearning. Granted, some may be equally mad, but you'll acquire some earth learning. Oh, yes, together we will be one. Every droplet is precious indeed. Your essence will then guard our fun. So hurry, come with speed. Mother Earth, another trap is set. We will entice these sapient fools. I promise to help remove this threat and preserve your wondrous jewels. End poem.
Great, Rican. I like the bite and the humor in the last stanza. But this does hit on that note of how people get lured into the ideas. Hey, we can do this. We can do this. Like going to Brazil and jumping off diving off 150 foot cliffs into the depths of the water down below. It's taking that chance, even though you know you shouldn't be there. There's a few places, I think, in Hawaii where you don't go to these places because they chew you up, they embattle you, and you never walk out alive. And yet, we keep striding across those noted danger lines, taking that chance. And And as a result, we pay for it because of our inherent, nothing's ever going to happen to me.
Yep. Exactly. Well, people do have a tendency to do that. Great comment. Yeah, I really like this one. It had great rhyme and flow. I like that he put it in the first-person narrative from the point of view of the Strid. I have to agree with what you said about how, you know, especially times if you get people in groups, it often seems if you get people in groups, you know, they start challenging each other, you know, and you know, it really shows how easy it is to get somebody to do something dangerous that they might otherwise think twice about. You know, I really enjoyed and appreciated the personification in this. The first-person narrative told from the perspective of the Strid. And not only does that have to do with the idea of, you know, as you were saying, how people, you know, are easily lured into danger. But, you know, there's definitely this, and in a humorous way, it does have this nice, dark, twisted humor, this fun humor. But it speaks on the idea of Mother Nature's anger towards mankind's mistreatment of the Earth. You know, and I really liked this all the way through. I especially like those last three stanzas with the idea of the mad souls trapped down there. You know, and the end lines, Mother Earth, another Trappist that we will entice these sapien fools. Great use of the word sapien. I promise to help remove this threat and preserve your wondrous jewels. So great lines and very well done.
All right, what do you
think? All right. That is a good question. All right, here we go. This is Bolton Strid by R. LaBarge. And go ahead, Rex.
Bolton Strid by R. LaBarge. A Yorkshire pitch, a narrow stream, gray border rocks of mossy green give way to torrents still unseen. A river wharf, a fulcrum joint, sharp limestone caves beneath that point, dark murky waters to anoint. A Scottish boy, a future king, embarked upon a youthful fling, was ground to pieces in that thing. A country path, a creekside ledge, stray not too close to ancient pledge, no one survives beyond its edge. And punk. All right.
Oh, great read there, Rex. I really like this one. In fact, like I said, all six of these poems were just, you know, top three quality. First of all, great rhyme and flow. I like the three lines. I like some of his word choices, like wharf and fulcrum and murky. And, you know, the three-line rhyming, there's something about it that looks so polished. Another thing I really appreciate about this, because this was something that I don't think anyone else put in their poem, if I remember right, was that he brought up the second-to-last stanza where he says, a Scottish boy, a future king, embarked upon a youthful fling, was ground to pieces in that thing. And if you read about the Bolton Strid, that it was one of the most famous deaths that happened there. There was a future king of Scotland that as a boy tried to jump the Strid and ended up drowning. So I really liked that he put in those little details like that. So very cool and very well done.
Nice. Well, there's quite a few stories on the Strid if you look for it. This walks in ominous tones. Got to start with that first line. A Yorkshire pitch, a narrow stream. The note of pitch offers up a sort of a beware what goes. This pitch is the pitch of darkness. A pitch is also a burnable essence. And pitch also the dark hollowness of that which you cannot see, the abyss. then rolls into that River Wharf Fulcrum Point. That's a nice touch there. That would be the Strangle Point, where it's kind of narrow before it opens up a little bit, and then the sharp limestone cave. Now that's a nice touch right there too. The actual noting the limestone caves, because that's where you get your hollowed out points where things get lost or placed for that which is. And a notable thought with the future king is a tale of lore that bids itself notability because of the fact that, hey, he was designated but never got to be placed on the throne. And then that thought with the back end, got a country path, creekside ledge, but it's got so much nice lichen and soft mold cover on it that you might think to sit and be eased. The fact that it's soft and alluring, yet that's where most people slip into and never come back out of. We've done R. Thank you very much.
I like that. I like that. Very cool. Great observations there, especially I really like the observations that you made on the word pitch and how it can represent so many different things. And it really gave the rite an extra layer that I hadn't thought about before. So very cool there. All right. And up next we have Amazing Places with Secret Dangers by Jenny the Deep. Careful where you jump in the rushing streams. The pristine river is not as clear as it seems. Watch your step on the slick rocks. Make sure you put on your water socks. Where the river meets the marshy swamp, beware of alligators' silent stomps. Staying where the rushing rapids flow before the cascading waterfalls is where to go. Unpredictable is Mother Nature and her currents. Walk slow with the current. Thing here is urgent. Take in all the alluring beauty the river has to offer. But take it easy and stay a while. Be still like old coffers. Life is like the running river. Spots can get murky. Don't let it take you under, ending your life early. End poem.
Great reading. This walks a different tone. This is that second stanza. Where the river meets the marshy swamp. Beware of alligators, silent stops. Staying where the rushing rapids flow before the cascading waterfalls is where to go. You want a place that doesn't hold the note of ease. Marshy swamp is outside of reverberating frogs all over the place, a catch of snake here and there. It is pretty much a quiet place, along with the usual haunts from the owls and other birds and so on. So you don't really want to hang out in a place like that. You want something where the river flows quite quickly. You see some fish jumping in, running out to that thought with the waterfalls, because you don't find alligators there. That's not their habitat. That's not something they place into. They want those murky places, those places where they can slide easily on their bellies into the water silently and take what they want that comes across their paths. But it's also on the idea of it isn't just the murky swamps. It's a matter of you might think it's a nice, easy place, but you don't see the eddying whirlpool that is off to the side, but until it's too late. And once you're caught in that eddying whirlpool, down you go. And then there's that thought also that a cascading waterfall, there's a note to being careful there too, because if you slip on that note, you get crushed on the rocks below. And that's where the last two lines come in, as this walks in that note of a sonnet. Life is like the running river. Spots can get murky. Don't let it take you under, ending your life early. The idea of understand where you're placing your feet. Nice, Jenny. All right, what about you?
I like what you had to say, that, you know, you have to understand the place you're at. And really, it's to me, speaks on the idea of how, you know, nature can be extremely cruel, but also and dangerous, but also just extremely beautiful and lovely. And it also speaks, and I think you kind of touched on this idea, that you really have to have awareness of your surroundings, you know, especially when it comes to water, you know. And I really like just where it says, unpredictable is Mother Nature and her currents. Walk slow with the current. Nothing here is urgent. Take in all the allure and beauty the river has to offer. You know, and I like that part that she throws in because, you know, it's for the most part a pretty dark ride. But when it says, walk slow with the current. Nothing here is urgent. Take in all the allure and beauty the river has to offer. I feel like there's a slight change of tone that works well. Because it's reminding us that you're not just slowing down for safety reasons, for practical reasons. You're slowing down because you actually have an opportunity to observe the beauty of nature. And so there's nothing worth, you know, hurrying for. So I really thought this was a great write by Jenny. And I like how she uses the river. She goes beyond the river, you know, to different water elements of Mother Nature. So very well done. And I suppose we'll want to know what's next.
Yep.
All right. I read your mind there. Scary. All right. Up next, we have Once Upon a Night by Truth Chills. And go ahead, Rex, and give that a read for us, please.
Once Upon a Night by Truth Chills. Would it not be nice to begin this plight with a catchy but non-climatic entry, like Once Upon a Time or Looking Up into the Midnight Sky? Yes. But for us who only see night after night as far back as the beginning, there could be no once upon a time, such as a human line. To think that far back would surely inspire insanity to provoke me yet again. I do not think this dreary countryside could bear being ravaged again. I most definitely could not bear watching priests and pastors working together, casting out demons and pointing false fingers, flinging accusations around in Latin, English and Greek, one overpowering the other as they get louder and louder. I say, where is their deity? Surely not in this ego-driven demonstration. I find myself looking around for some sort of confirmation that God is okay with this abomination. Holy water splashing, crosses lifted into the air, the crosses lifted high, poor altar boys, it's no wonder they begin to resent this pious job. The cross is heavier than they are, while the priest swings around an oversized yo-yo, with smoke disguising their snide faces as they stroll to the front, readying their performances. I am the accused, already deemed guilty, no matter that my plea is quite the opposite, no matter that this mob of super monks welcome themselves inside my house, waking me from my bloodlust sleep at 5:45, daylight waning, panic fills my cold, dead heart, but these fools mistake my squinched up face as a sign that their threats invoke fear. On the contrary, Padre, it stirs my anger, which in turn provokes the immortal me, who whispers, feast on this gift of sin-tainted blood that flows through these so-called men of God. I resisted the pull of their sweat-soaked hands just enough to cause one to turn and look, and that was all it took. Now, 7:15, I retreat into my candlelit cabin and wipe the blood from these heathens from my mouth and hands. From priest to pitchfork farmer, I tasted the end of this place that I invested so much of me in. Onward to the next night, to the next once upon a time. And poem. All right. What do you got for that?
Well, great read there, Rex. This was actually from the one carryover from the Break On Through contest featuring the poetry of Olga Orozco. And Truth Chills put that, in her end, I went more with the rhythm of her poem than actual single poems, than actual single poem. And that was absolutely fine with me. You know, I often tell people that, you know, when it comes to longer prompts like poems, they can be inspired by any part or just the general vibe, you know. So I thought this was a strong write. I really like Truth Chill's straightforward style. There's always kind of a raw honesty to it. You know, I felt like she did a wonderful job of capturing the vibe of Olga Oresko's poetry, the hard-hitting, raw, emotive write. And I like how this is, it feels like, well, first of all, it speaks on, I think, hypocrisy that often happens in many religions. And the idea of being hunted down, you know, of course, with the priest to pitchforked farmer, I see at the end of this place, you know, it has that, you know, Frankenstein's monster type feel to it. The idea that because you don't agree with 100% with a certain religion, the idea of being judged and hunted down and treated you know, Frankenstein's monster. I thought this was an emotive write on the idea of being hunted down by those eager to push religion down your throat. And I also like the kind of the bit of twisted humor in here too. You know, with the, you know, priests swinging around in oversized yo-yo with smoke disguising their snide faces as they stroll to the front ready. They're readying their performance. And then, of course, no matter what this mob of super monks, I love the phrase super monks because, you know, it's fun. But there's a kind of a darkness to it. The idea of, you know, being hunted like Frankenstein's monster, welcome themselves inside my house, waking me from my bloodless sleep. At 5:45, daylight waning, panic fills my cold heart, cold dead heart. But these fools mistake my squinched up face as a sign that their threats invoke fear. you know, it also, I have to say, you know, it's a nice layered right because it's not only about being judged, but I think it makes her a good, you know, vampiric tale. You know, it's got a nice classic horror story vibe, like Dracula, or as I was saying, Frankenstein. So excellent write and very well done.
I like that bit with the yo-yo. I thought that was funny, relating to the thermal. That's definitely a different way of looking at it, yet it does kind of offer up that notion of walking the dog from way back when. I think the idea, and this walks a little deeper, the fact that she's walking back in time as though we've actually reverted to that angle because of what's going on. The thought that where everything could be cured with a note to religious attitude. And most of that is probably true, except where it comes to certain things. Because before we knew anything, there was that note to the fact that the plague was thought to come through bad air, hence the mask the doctors wore, thinking that wouldn't pass through them, the note of putting a pocket full of posies, the idea of warding off that which you don't understand with the smell of smell of posies in your pocket, something ward off the bad air. It comes with that note of people who keep walking back into those moments of time where they're blaming everything in a particular direction in order to create that fallacy of thought. Evil lurks here within this, and that's all that matters. They've lost themselves into an idea of where we can only believe this singularity as opposed to the reality of walking into and understanding by learning instead of just a question, instead of denying and then accusing and then fingering and then claiming they must be eradicated. I think that's the biggest part of this piece here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great comment there, Rex. wonderful observations on the on human behavior. So, all right, well, now we are going to get into the rights from the contest, Agatha Christie. So, which, yeah, I'm thought she had some just really awesome quotes from her books. I would probably honestly do another contest on her, even though this one didn't get a lot of rights. You know, I just thought she had some great lines from her books. And all right, well, this is Haunting Illusions by Betty Page. Sing to me, my sweet, my alluring femme fatale. Mesmerize my dreams. I'm not what I seem, dressed up, seductively slick, illuminating. To you, I'm a ghost, although I'm much more than that, strolling down hallways, dancing in ballrooms, mischievously pranking. I get off on fear, playing with your mind, swinging high from chandeliers, upside down ceilings. I'm a vampire who's viciously immortal, a succubus deer. I make your walls shake, open window curtains, blow so romantically. I light up candles or quickly blow them all out, having a good time. We all gather here, demons, angels, succubus, vampires, ghouls, ghosts, trapped in this mansion day after day, will haunt you as if we're alive. Solve our mysteries. Be the one to set us free, Agatha Christie. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Thank you very much. Those last two stanzas hit on the note of the whole thing. The idea of everyone gathered here, that note to a house, a mansion, an arena, that everyone is gathered in because they can't escape it. And then that finish off, solve our mysteries, be the one to set us free, Agatha Christie. The note to the books, the enjoyment that people got out of them. And that's where the first one chooses. The first eight stanzas come in, offering up those little tidbits. The cursory wind that blows for no reason, the candle that goes out in a room that's closed up, the thought of something whispering along the back of your neck, or a sudden shake where there shouldn't be a shake. So there's the tease in those first eight stanzas just to finish out with the literality of, please, come share the mysteries of your mind. Nice, Betty. All right, Kim, what about you?
Yeah, well, I thought, well, first of all, as always, wonderful 575 line. But Betty did write to prompt 13, which was the quote, very few of us are what we seem. I did like that ending. I mean, I like this all the way through, but, you know, I do enjoy a good twist at the end. And the fact that, you know, that it was, you know, that you realize at the end that all these creatures, these succubus, these angels, these vampires, ghouls, ghosts, all are gathered together, all want the mystery of their entrapment, the mystery of their murder solved, and they're turning to the one person that they know can get it done. And, of course, that is Agatha Christie. So I really felt like not only was this a great fantasy poem, a dark fantasy poem, but it was a nod towards the author and towards her well-known style of writing mystery novels. I also did really like where she says, we all gather here, demons, angels, succubus, vampires, ghouls, ghosts, because I thought throwing the angels in there was a nice touch. Because, you know, it makes you think of the idea of fallen angels. You know, and then, of course, she just has some really fun lines. Like, you know, to you I'm a ghost, although I'm much more than that. Strolling down hallways, dancing in ballrooms, mischievously pranking, I get off on fear. Playing with your mind, swinging high from chandeliers, upside down ceilings, like, you know, playing with your mind, swinging high from chandeliers. It's just some really great darkness that, although she says I'm a vampire, really makes you think of the idea of, like, some of the behavior of a poltergeist. So I thought this was a very cool light and very well done.
All right, what next?
All right, up next we have, oh, that doesn't help because that's the same poem. Let me go grab the next one. All right, and let me find one that is, there we go, of course. Good old Mystic Muse. I will grab his. And, all right, we have The Price by Mystic Muse. Go ahead, Rex.
The Price by Mystic Muse. For everything I've loved, there's been a price. Sometimes the cost has been too hard to bear. I took a chance, but love rolls loaded dice, and now my wounded heart has ceased to care. Amour's a game maneuvered by the fates. Sometimes we win, but oftentimes we lose. It's hard to take the grief it generates, and that is why so many sing the blues. Love makes us high, but it can take its toll. I know my injured heart will never heal. It's carved a massive scar upon my soul and left my heart without a will to heal. End poem. All right.
Great read there, Rex. As always, you know, a wonderful write by Dave. Spot on rhyme and flow. You know, and he wrote to the quote, but surely for everything you love, you have to pay some price. And, you know, I thought this was a great take on that and the idea of the game of love and taking chances. You know, I really liked this all the way through, but some of my favorite lines were where it says, I took a chance of love rolled dice. And then, you know, it's hard to take the grief it generates. That is why so many sing the blues. I think falling in love and heartbreak is something that many of us can relate to. I also like where it says, love makes us high, but it can take a toll. I like that line because I find it very relatable because I feel like it's not just about love, but I don't know about other people. For me personally, if something makes me, like, extremely happy, and then it ends, you know, there's that drop. And I think that happens to many of us, you know. So that really, the strong emotive lines on the idea of willingly playing the game of love, realizing the dice are loaded, and, you know, realizing how difficult it is to heal from those emotional scars once you've been hurt. So, excellent write and very well done.
Yep, it's the bites and consequences and how that reflects upon one, especially if you don't learn moving forward and you keep getting bitten again and again, and you have that that down attitude towards thing, which is kind of walks in that nature. Sometimes we win, but oftentimes we lose. It's hard to take the grief it generates, and that is why so many sing the blues. And the idea of keep walking the same vein without actually having taken anything from the last generated effort, which kind of pushes some people over the edge and makes them hard-hearted, so to speak. So, nicely done, Dave. Thank you very much. All right. Next.
Well, let me mosey on over and see what we have next. All right. And up next, we have My Husband Digs These Bones. And she wrote to the prompt, this is by Darkened Auras, and she wrote to the prompt, an archaeologist is the best husband a woman can have. the older she gets, the more interested he is in her. My husband is an archaeologist. He has been for 60 years. We met on a dig as I photographed, and we dug each other's careers. We went on dates of scavenger hunts. It was our little special bonding thing. And he'd present beautiful scenes for me to capture for our Kodaks in the spring. We're pushing in our 80s now, though you'll still hear the sweet joy in my tones. He loves me more every year. He's really into this old bag of bones and poem. I do like that.
And great read. All right, human thing to finish off with, nice. But it walked in a different kind of note to life, the understanding. There's give and take here that walks beyond the pale, so to speak. She understands his work and doesn't mind it and would gladly go on the digs because it offers up the scenery and an enormity of world that she might not normally see otherwise. Thoughts of going on those digs from ancient Rome, Greece, the Middle East, and Egypt, wherever, and you get a feel for the food as well as the that part of the world, and you can actually develop a storyline on that. So it walks flavorfully, and then they're offering up of he really digs really into these old bag of bones, walks that very same line because. Being an archaeologist, your appreciation goes with the age that comes with the bones itself. So they kind of got a nice hand-in-hand touch to it. What about you?
I like these thoughts. I like that. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I like this. It was a great rhyming poem, wonderful humor. I like that, you know, it's a great story poem on the idea of this couple that are really just made for each other, you know, they get along nicely, their careers match up. You know, I liked the nod towards the Kodak camera. You know, I thought that was really cool. The wordplay, like when she says, and we dug each other's careers, you know, not only the digging, but the idea of using the word dug is like, you know, I that slang of, I really like it. And of course those end lines are great. You know, that really made me smile. He loves me more every year. He's really into this old bag of bones. You know, great line. Very well done. All right, let's see what we have next. Do-do-do. All right. Up next we have Unholy Undoings by Jenny the Deep. And we do have a SoundCloud for that one. So here we go.
Unholy Undoings. Wrapped up in a web of lies, her love for him she could no longer disguise. After months of being clever behind their family's backs, their lives came crashing down as his glasses cracked. Falling to his knees on the ground of pebbles now dead inside, burying the evidence with a jaded heart, he burns them alive. Her ring he kept as his love's morbid token. Stoic, left confounded, he returns home broken. His children ask where their mommy is, wanting food in their hungry tummies. Not knowing of her dirty deeds, dear old daddy, his lies, he proceeds with. Never knowing whatever truly happened to their mom, believing she abandoned them for another man soon. Unbeknownst, the unholy acts both parents have truly done, loving another was the not-so-clever adulterer's undoing. End poem.
Great read, Jenny. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. All right, Pam. What do you got?
Yes, yes. SoundClouds are definitely always appreciated. I thought this was a wonderful dark write. And, you know, I like how she went into reality with it. Like, to me, what I feel like is reality. And it's the reality of people, like a couple, a husband and wife, that both have their sins, both have their, you know, basically... to me, it's about this idea of this marriage falling apart because neither one of them is respecting marriage. And it's the children that are suffering because, you know, you can see this idea of them, you know, each plays their part in the downfall. And each, you know, there's like you can't point fingers at any one person. You know, as she says, the undoing, you know, of this relationship isn't something that you can point just a finger at one person. I really thought there was a strong emotional impact in his children ask where their mommy is, wanting food in their hungry tummy, not knowing of her dirty deeds, dear old daddy, his lies he proceeds with. You know, and I think at that part, though, it kind of speaks on a white lie, the idea of, you know, a lying to children in order to, you know, protect them from the kind of things that children shouldn't have to worry about. You know, so just a wonderful dark tale and very well done.
Nice. Okay, well. According to Jenny here, she's at fault. Look at that opening. Wrapped up in a web of lies, her love for him she could no longer disguise. After months of being clever behind their family's backs, their lives came crashing down as his glasses cracked. That second stanza walks to the husband, offering up that note to killing him, burying him, and then taking a token, the wedding ring. Ooh. And then that thought of, you know, can't tell the kids, hey, maybe you're stuck up. She's gone. And then let them think what they do around. But it also hits on that note of, revenge is a meal best served cold or else. You might as well dig two graves because you're both going down. In this case, it would have been three, but since you buried them together, that's a singularity. And with the understanding that you've done me wrong, I took my revenge, yet you pay for it in the long run because there are other avenues that need to be taken care of. And obviously, he kind of descends into jaded and darkened, which kind of leaves the kids out of the equation or on the back burner of the equation. So her deed bespoils everything as his deed kills everything. So nicely done there, Jenny.
I have to agree, yeah. Absolutely. A wonderful comment. All right. Do-do-do-do-do. All right. I'm checking something here. Do-do-do. All right. Let's see. Ah, there we go. All right. Up next. We have Undeniable Truth by Matt29. And go ahead, Rex.
Undeniable Truth by Matt29. The truth, however ugly in itself, is always curious and beautiful to seekers after it. Agatha Christie, and that was quote. Our perception of reality is not always correct. In literature, both Alice and Lucy discover new worlds, each altering their perspective viewpoint of life, enabling them to see a fresh reality to before. In movies, too, life is often not how it seems to be. Neo is given the option of two pills in the Matrix, releasing him from the connection to the hub, enabling freedom and an inconceivable truth. We always have the notion that our life is correct. There is nothing we can change, and this is set. We are married, working in jobs, and have children. Change is not possible due to bills and commitments. What if this is not correct, and there is another truth? Where we follow the natural vibration of expression, life is effortless when we do work involving our unique skills. Money flows freely due to our unique talent and recognition. Are we really aware of the truth of life and the possibilities it offers? And all right, what do you think?
Now, great read there, Rex. I like this one. First of all, I think this was honestly one of my favorite quotes. I've always been a fan of quotes that have to do with seeking the truth and not always, you know, expecting it to be beautiful. You know, I really like how I'm beginning to really enjoy and appreciate Matt 29's writing and how with a very straightforward language, he provides a nice philosophical element. I like that he brings in like cultural references, you know, like Alice in Wonderland and Lucy. I assume Lucy's in the Star with Diamonds, so that could be somebody else. I'm trying to think, but where he says, who is Lucy? Oh, Lucy from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Yes, okay. Geez. I was thinking, I see Lucy, and I think either Peanuts or Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds from the Beatles. You know, but I really like that. In literature, both Alice and Lucy discovered new worlds, each altering their perspective viewpoint of life, enabling them to see a fresh reality to before. You know, and I like how he brings in the Matrix and Neo. Neo is given the option of two pills in the Matrix, releasing him from the connection to the hub, enabling freedom and an inconceivable truth. So what I like is that he used these references of literature and movies to show that, you know, if we are going to find a truth, you know, we actually have to seek it out. We actually have to be willing to ask those questions, you know, to look and be willing to change our perspectives. You know, so just an amazing write and very well done.
Nice. Well, yeah, perception of reality is not always correct. It's true there. And then the idea of indulging in literature and movies, which offers up something else, an escape within those particular venues. And then we always have the notion that our life is correct. A good portion of people do. There's nothing we can change, and this is said before. We are married, working jobs, and have children. The idea of this fear within that note, change is not possible due to bills and commitments. Again, fear of the unknown, which kind of locks people into it, which also hits on that note of in finding something you love to do and not having to work a day in your life. That notion of too many people locked into arenas that they're not happy in, and maybe the idea of they took the wrong turn when they decided what they wanted to do, and all of a sudden finding out 10, 15, 20 years down the road, they hate it, can't stand it, yet they kind of lock themselves in place because it's a viable notation with what comes in the door monetarily. There is never enough on the back end for them to actually offer up the change and the possibility. And those last few lines hit on that idea of if you do what you love, then you never have to work a day in your life.
Absolutely. I'm glad you focused on that part because that was a part I had noticed earlier, but forgot about it. So I'm glad you brought that back up. I really liked your comments, but especially where you were talking about your observations on how important it is to have a career where, you know, you love what you're doing, you know, because, yeah, too oftentimes in life, it does feel like, you know, we've taken these long turns and ended up where we're not supposed to be. So, very cool. All right. So
reminds me of that there's a guy who does YouTubes. He's a builder or a fabricator of cars. His name's Bad Chad. He said he'd worked a number of crap jobs that he wasn't happy with, and then he hit on the idea of taking old cars and repurposing them into something else. And he got so good to the point where he actually had a TV show on A&E or whatever channel it was for 3 years. And now he does it full time and he builds some amazing cars. And he does, he gets an old car. You know, he won't fully deck it out to his point, but then he's got other cars that he's built from the ground up and they're really amazing pieces of work. But he's working on one now, a 58 Ford Thunderbird. It was the first year of the very long Thunderbird.
Nice.
The 55, 56, and 57 Thunderbirds were the two-seat short models. He's taken this 58 and he's turning it into the first 3 years by cutting out a portion of the roof, moving the roof up, making it a two-seater, and by filling in the rest of the car with the metalwork and fabrication to make the flow of the trunk space going up to the back window as a new reconfiguration, but also the same flow design, yet turning it into a two-seater. So it looks pretty cool.
That does. So when you say refurbished, basically he's making it into another model car. Like he doesn't turn like a car into, say, like a couch or a bed.
Oh no, he's keeping them as cars. He's just he'll chop the roofs down. He'll shorten. He's actually shortened up cars. He makes longer cars.
Oh wow.
He made one car he calls the Cruella de Vil car. And it's a gorgeous piece of work, complete with old body stores in the 30s. He picks up cars people no longer want. They're just kind of hanging around. He doesn't pay a lot for them. And he creates something new out of that car, giving it a new look.
That actually sounds really fascinating. What's his name?
Bad Chad.
I will have to check that out. That might actually be something Nessa would watch with me. So very cool. Very cool.
And he goes through it step by step. He goes into teaching mode. He teaches how to not only cut out the rot, but how to actually put back in pieces, welding, sanding, painting. He does the whole thing. So it's a matter of how you look at it.
You know what? And that is actually a really good example of somebody who, you know, gets into something that they love doing. And it really does, I think, make a huge difference. I mean, there's no guarantee that you're going to be a famous YouTuber or get a TV show, but at least you have personal contentment. You know, so.
Well, he's done well enough to actually build himself I wouldn't call it a barn because it's made out of steel, corrugated steel, a huge building on the back of his property to house all the cars that he's built that he's kept for himself. And his girlfriend just bought herself a nice 2020 Corvette, baby blue with a black streak down the side of it, gorgeous looking car.
Ooh, nice. I like that. Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, what do you say? Shall we go on to the next one?
Yep.
All right. So this next one, written by Weaver of Dreams, who did not provide a SoundCloud, which is okay because, you know, our dear Kate provides plenty of SoundCloud, is actually written in two parts. Part one is the murderer, and part two is Agatha Christie. So I figure, Rex, you can read The Murderer, and I can read Agatha Christie.
All right. Cheap Cologne and Christie by Weaver of Dreams. I know that every time I commit another murder, I am one step closer to being caught. Although the thrilling sound of that last breath makes me lean in, my emotions fraught. Why am I taking such stupid risks? I have no idea. Boredom? I thought these acts would make history. Maybe I need a gimmick that shocks, instills fear, and would pique interest, perhaps be noticed by Christie. If I were immortalized within the pages of a book on crime, my name would be remembered. My finest hour would be elevated for that one daring act. If I could stalk, cause consternation, then commit the murder of Agatha Christie.
For days, I've had a feeling that I am being watched by someone who has a questionable hygiene routine. The stench of cheap cologne seems to hover then, follows me where'er I go. Now I have to see him. I go into a lion's cafe, sit where I can see into a mirror, though the door comes in, through the door comes an unkempt-looking chap with the eyes of a madman, with vile-smelling cheap cologne. He sits close behind me, looking both manic and excited. Before he can muster the resolve to act, a mistake in a public place, I remove my hat and give a slight wave. Within seconds, burly policemen surround him on all sides. He's hustled away, and I can breathe, feeling less than brave. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Thank you very much. I'm going to walk this. Very few of us see what we've seen, or what we think. She might be a thought in this kind of walking in that note of why she disappeared for a while. But I kind of liken this to the fact that in order to come up with how she walks, she's got to place herself in the mind of a murderer. So she offers up those first three stanzas, the thought of how he thinks. And then on the back end, thinks as herself within the mind of, say, Poirot or Miss Marple, as to how you work down the back end of things. So you put yourself in the place of in the manner of being hunted while offering up the front end of yourself as the one doing the hunter. So you're both hunter and prey in the same mode, but you're walking through the routine and you go through it. Like I go into a lion's cafe, sit where I can see into a mirror. You need those little notations, those little insignificant things. Yes, they're not insignificant in the moment because they paint something later on down the road, or they offer up a clue as to the imagery within the character being portrayed. And therefore, you get to play on both ends against the middle because you've got to have your opening motif with the character murderer. And you've also got to have the one who's being hunted, so to speak, and how they would react in the moment. So it's the author playing both angles in on herself.
I like that.
What about you?
I like it. Well, first of all, I have to say you read your part really well. And I like the idea that this is the thought of it being the author getting into the mind of the murderer, then her own mind, it is fascinating, the mystery of her disappearance. And I was reading about that and how there's debate on was she truly mentally ill or was she just, trying to get, was it like a publicity and the fact that it never was completely resolved. But, I like what you have to say, but I do think this is actually like a murder mystery, like with two different voices. Like, I really think it is supposed to be literally a murderer and then literally the author. But, you know, I think it works well either way. It is nicely layered. And I really like her word choices. You know, I wish I could pull off an Agatha Christie accent, you know, for a whole read because, you know, it's her being from England. I assume she doesn't sound like she's from Wisconsin. But great word choices here, like peak and gimmick and consternation and huckled. I like that. He's huckled away. And I like, this is definitely, it's got a great Agatha Christie vibe to it where you really get to know the characters and you can see the obsession that this murderer has in becoming infamous, you know. And if I were immortalized within the pages of a book on crime, my name would be remembered. My finest hour would be elevated for that one daring act, you know. So just a wonderful lines all the way through and very well done.
All right, where we go?
That is a good question. All right. Up next we have No Need to Look Hard by Julie Buck. I haven't known how to live my life for a long time now. Sometimes I don't even feel like I have one. It left me or I left it. I can't remember my misery to morph. I can't permit my misery to morph into some mutation of joy, for I need my misery to blame as to why I'm this way. I blame no one and everyone. My chronic anguish makes me acutely aware of what's on the other side of this purgatory. I worry that to put aside my suffering would transmit to not caring, and that can never be. I create my own tormented playground and ride thoughts that just go round and round, knowing I'm cheating myself out of the grandiosity of life is a hard fact to eat. My emotional restrictions aside, I envy those with fat lives, but mine, despite huge wonderment, is still pretty goddamn petite. End poem.
Great read. I don't know, kind of a two-tone temporality. That need and, let's see, to morph into some mutation of joy. For I need my misery to blame as to why I'm this way. Misery loves company, but in this note, it's kind of the enjoying the note of misery in and of itself. Blame no one and everyone, kind of contradiction in terms, almost a note of duality of mentality, the highs and lows of, I forget what that is now, and understanding. There is an understanding note with that, the highs and lows of a mind that walks that veil, yet still understand. I create my own torment. Tormented playground, and right thought, but just go round and round, knowing I'm cheating myself out of this grandiosity of life is a hard fact to eat. There's a whole lot of understanding note to this, and so my thought with the doesn't play out because that kind of walks a different tone. This is someone who really, really does enjoy the miserableness that is almost held as sacrosanct. Take it away, and there's nothing there to enjoy at all. All right, there you go.
Well, cool observations there, Rex. And, you know, I think oftentimes, especially, like, I feel like it speaks on depression and the idea that oftentimes it's better to feel that misery than to not feel anything at all. I think it also kind of touches on the thought that, you know, misery loves company. And oftentimes, you know, people want to, for nosy reasons, get involved with somebody who's miserable. And also for good reasons. I can't say that, you know, everybody's reasoning, you know, but, you know, so, and that's, misery loves company and wants other people to be, you know, sad with it. And I like that this speaks on the idea of having a life that isn't grandiose, isn't big. It's in fact kind of rather ordinary. And I think, you know, with that idea, it's almost like the misery is the one thing that makes it unordinary. And she did write to the quote, "I like living. I have sometimes been wildly, desperately, acutely miserable, racked with sorrow. But through it all, I still know quite certainly that just to be alive is a grand thing." You know, and I always like how Julie does her first-person narrative. She's got wonderful, hard-hitting lines. This idea of being in your own personal torment, your own personal hell that is part of your mind, it really does make me think of somebody who's gotten so used to a life of depression, they don't know where to go from there. It's what they're used to. I really like particularly that stanza that says, "I blame no one and everyone. My chronic anguish makes me acutely aware of what's on the other side of this purgatory." Wonderful use of the word purgatory. Very well done.
All right. What's up next?
All right. And up next we have Urban Enchantment by Vamped Vixen. And go ahead, Rex.
Urban Enchantment by Vamped Vixen. Her iridescent wings have long since blended in among granite edges of the city skyline, mimicking the marching ants in this colony, the frantic to and fro by the Hudson River. Pointed ears tucked behind raven hair, and all her secrets they will never know. Camouflaged behind bustling street vendors, she weaves like gold thread in an ancient tapestry of neon signs shimmering like her own magic spells, pretzels lacking the flavor of ambrosia at home, and a symphony of angry honking taxicabs. Walking within wisps, those misty trails of steam escaping the subway underground, vapor curtains coil around her petite frame like hot breaths of her pet dragon. This fairy flits from shadow to shadow, ducking by as foreign feet pound the pavement, no one noticing the sparkles in her violet eyes. How she whispers melodies of eternal unknown as she tiptoes through this concrete jungle. Her shooting star flies past their daylight, a bright comet blazing through blue sky, unseen by humans, blighted by their earthly ties. But for those who still dream by lullabies, holding their hand out for a butterfly's kiss, for detectives seeking enchantment on the breeze, they'll never miss the faint sweet scent of lavender and fairy rings in the wandering footsteps of her wake. End poem. All right, what do you get?
Great read. Great read there, Rex. I'm blanking out on what the name of the show is, and I actually watched the first season of it and really liked it. Do you remember the name of the show?
I don't even know what it is.
Okay,
what
well,
was
it's
it
a
about?
Really cool... I think it's Carnival Row or something like that. It's the one where this guy is a detective, and it takes place in the same time as approximately when Jack the Ripper would be around in London. And he's human, and the main character, the girl, like in that picture, she's a fairy. And, you know, basically it's the idea is that the fairies all get put into the slum area and are getting killed off, and nobody cares because they're treated like secondhand citizens. But it's actually, if you get a chance to watch, if you haven't already, I do recommend it. it is a good series. Of course, I've only watched one season, but, you know, the one season is good. You know, I like that this poem stands on its own. Like, you don't actually need to know the show to appreciate the poem. But, you know, it also, like, if you know the show, then, you know, there's little tidbits that you can definitely appreciate. Like the, you know, the mention of the iridescent wings, or even like the frantic to and fro by the Hudson River. I thought bringing in the Hudson River, you know, the river that you know, through New York and other states, obviously, was a nice touch with the attention to detail. You know, also, she brings in the chaos and the anger of not only that time period, but, you know, a big city in that time period. And if you can imagine, you know, just going from this beautiful, magical, peaceful place to a violent, you know, Victorian era New York. And I think she, Vamped Vixen has done a great job of capturing that when she says, camouflage behind bustling street vendors, she weaves like gold thread in an ancient tapestry of neon signs shimmering like her own magic spell, pretzels lacking the flavor of ambrosia at home, and a symphony of angry honking taxi cabs. So you can just see the chaos created, not only with the imagery, but with the noise and the main character having to adjust to that environment. So great write and very well done.
Well said. Kind of reminds me of the sort of, it's Cole Caldwell wrote, they did two seasons, canceled season three. Reminds me of, this is obviously modern day because she offers up that note to angry honking taxi cabs. This kind of reminds me of another show that was done. It's called Penny Dreadful, which was done in Victorian England around time, Jack the Ripper, vampires, zombies, you name it, all manner of evil that walked in, and you had these people going out destroying what they could within that society, because it was raising up, getting quite dangerous with all these things edging out of the darkness into the light. But I guess this kind of walks the same thing, except she's... Although the picture, it does offer up her wings, so there must be an invisible motif to most people, except those on that back end who still dream by lullabies. A nice note there, holding their hand out for a butterfly's kiss. It's on the notion of maybe the natural order of things, where it could be, instead of, as she puts it here, the concrete jungle. She offers up that note to a pet dragon. And it does hit on the idea of placing so many people into a very small arena that it becomes nothing but a congested nightmare. Nicely done, V.
Exactly. Well said there, Rex. All right. And up next we have The Angels in Your Life by My Angel 3. At this very moment, you're dwelling on a tiny lost angel, daydreaming as she feels the same amount of mist in her heavenly heart as you do in this mortal pit. You're wishing away the gaping abyss between here without her and there by her side. You're curious if she stares into the same chasm and makes the identical wish. Sinister voices are suggesting how to close the gap, how a precisely placed snick on the correct artery would transport you to her. Better voices remind you of the beauty you'd be at forsaking, the pain you'd leave behind. You're thinking about how guilty every second of your existence feels. Every breath of mortal air feels like you stole it from her. You wish you could barter your breath for hers, trade places, and allow her the precious life she deserved. She has a brother now. He's nothing like her, yet exactly the same. He's just about perfect, and so was she. And she chose prompt 14, which was the same one that Julie Buck chose. And in her AN, she puts that this was written for a dear friend's daughter who suffered the loss of an angel baby girl and was blessed to have a healthy rainbow baby. A rainbow baby is a baby born after a miscarriage, ectopic pregnancy, molar pregnancy, termination for medical reasons, stillbirth, or neonatal death. The rainbow symbol has been used by members of the baby loss community for many years. Ah, man, that's beautiful and sad. I just wanted to share that again.
You didn't need to read that. I got that from just that last stanza alone. Interesting.
Oh, no, I know, but I read it mainly for our listening audience.
Well, it's interesting she waited
and
for that last
stanza. Because I felt like it needed to be read.
It's interesting she waited to that last stanza to offer up the reality of what is, especially considering the notations got instance the voice not suggesting how to close the gap, how a precisely placed snick on the correct artery could transport you to her. This does, until then, everything hits on the emptiness of having a loved one gone, but until that last stanza, you don't realize just how close to home and heart it hits at the loss of a baby. Even with that note of a tiny lost angel, you always consider your kids a tiny lost angel. But in that moment, you could roll the thought, this is about someone who's lived a life with this person until you get to that last stanza, and wishing upon the notation of giving one's life over so that they may fully enjoy that life. But this does work. Harsh notes with that last stanza itself. Oof. Like they've done my angels. All right. What about you?
Yeah. This is a powerful, you know, it's such a sad thing to me when a woman, you know, when a family loses a baby, you know, and I've known women who've gone through this. Of course, you know, men who've gone through this in their own way, because, you know, it's their children too. I thought it was just wonderful and heartfelt that she wrote this for her friend, and I am so sorry for her friend's loss. You know, I like the imagery in this. I like how she put so much heart into it. And it is dark because, you know, there is a darkness and there is a sense of depression when losing a child. And there are those, you know, that your conscience speaking to you and telling you different things, like, you know, how to, you know, pay the price, how to bring yourself closer. But then also your conscience that, you know, saying that, you know, no, you know, stay living. There are more blessings to come. There is hope, you know, and I really like this all the way through, but I especially like where it's, to me, philosophical, where it says, you're curious if she stares into the same chasm and makes the identical wish. I don't know about identical wish, but I do feel with my own personal beliefs that, you know, the innocent children and babies, you know, go to heaven, and they are watching down on us, you know. But of course, that's just my beliefs, and, you know. So, and I also really like it. You were mentioning the end stands. I thought that was great. She has a brother now. He's nothing like her, yet exactly the same. He's just about perfect, and so was she. And I like that because not only does it is the idea of the rainbow baby, but it's the idea to me that and so how when you have more than one kid, you will always notice the similarities and the differences. And there will definitely, no matter how many kids you have, there will be those differences because they are each a unique individual. So excellent writing, very well done.
All right, where are we going now?
All right, let's see here. Up next, we have Janice by Benny D. And go ahead, Rex.
Janice by Benny D. There is a sound I fear that it would unravel my resolute abode, a cabin with no egress save what I have hidden in the shadows, the manifestation of aching memories. Alone there remained to me a gentle spring where the water reveals swaying revenants, colors morphing endlessly that in a glance readily formed its shapes from the past. I cannot trust my eyes, but when closing them, what I hear becomes amplified, resonating ever closer with the swell of ripples. Hold fast to the width of your ears, that firmament of wisdom that has been your vigil through the ordeal. Ride the deluge as you have before. An almost imperceptible shift in weight betrays the corporeal resolve, bracing for the impact to come. If that sound, the voice that would haunt me should pass into this mire of a stoic void, it would echo in vain along the cavern walls with only the rattle of a few rocks that give way. And yet, if I were to slightly lower my gaze in anticipation of its self-augured truth, I would see my wavering hand reaching out, ready to open the door and pump.
Great read there, Rex. Benny D. wrote to prompt number 4, which is, but surely for everything you love, you have to pay some price. I actually thought another one that this would fit well with is none of us are what we seem. You know, and the reason I thought that because of the title Janice, which, you know, Janice being the Roman god of, you know, beginnings, dates, transitions, time, duality, doorways, and was often depicted with two faces. So I thought there was a sense of, you know, somebody, you know, offering up those two faces. I don't know if I've seen Benny D a whole lot. I do recognize that picture. Maybe with somebody who changed their name. I don't know. But either way, I'm glad they were inspired. I really like how this does focus on the idea of trust and perspective and wondering, you know, about what you're seeing. Like where it says, I cannot trust my eyes, but when closing them, what I hear becomes amplified, resonating ever closer with the swell of ripples. Strong imagery and metaphors. I also really like, if that sound, the voice that would haunt me, should pass into this mire of stoic void, it would echo in vain along the cavern walls with only the rattle of a few rocks that give way. I really feel like, you know, there's this idea of being hurt by love and your own heart becoming, your spirit becoming that stoic void, your heart hardening. And, then at the end, that idea of, I would see my wavering hand reaching out, ready to open the door, you know, ready to open, that door to things that you were afraid to be offered up before. Another part I really like is bringing in Virgil. It holds fast to width of your years, that firmament of wisdom that has been your Virgil through the ordeal. Virgil, of course, being the one who led who was it, Dante, through the 9 levels of hell, was the older gentleman And so I like that that's become the idea of learning to trust your own judgment, learning to trust your own wisdom. So great write and very well done.
Well, yeah, also right up front, there is a sound I fear that it would unravel my resolute abode, a cavern with no egress save what I have hidden in the shadows, the manifestation of aching memories, the fear of giving up those memories. Alone there remains to me a gentle spring where the water reveals swaying remnants, colors morphing endlessly that in a glance readily form into shapes from the past. Again, that note to in creating that spring of aching memories that one holds on to and fears giving up for what might come from giving those up. The thought can't trust his eyes, and the thought of everything being amplified, echoing, and then swelling with ripples on that river, so to speak. Then that note, hold fast to the wits of your years. There is that note of keeping it together, the firmament of wisdom, and that has been your virtue through the ordeal, why the deluge as you have before. But there is a kind of turning point right there. The shift in weight kind of hits that notion of that which is being removed from your shoulders, so to speak, betrays the corporeal resolve, opening up the notion of real life itself, and then you brace for the impact of that because you think the other shoe is going to drop. The back yet is with the and if I was slightly to lower my gaze in anticipation of the self-augured truth, I would see my wavering hand reaching out ready to open the door. There is that note of looking in the mirror or looking in that pool of placid water where you can actually see your own reflection and that self-augured truth being you understand the notation. In order to grow, you have to walk past that which you harbor within those aching memories that you long to hold on to. You cannot move forth without actually unburdening yourself with that weight. And to do that, you have to be willing to open that door and step through. And that's the first angle, the first notation. It is like that note to Dante's Inferno or the Dante's whatchamacallit. That door to the door of going into hell. Lasciate ogni speranza voi contratti. Beware ye who enter here. For hell, it is that notation of where you're going. For the representation here, it is a notation of things that change upon passing through that door.
Absolutely. Very cool comment there, Rex. All right. Well, the last poem for the night is actually my poem, and it is a shorty, so I figure I can put it in. And this is inspired by, I did not deceive you, mon ami. At most, I permitted you to deceive yourself. And it's the game willingly played. Mon ami, you say that I am wicked with deception in my heart. But the truth, my dear, is you willingly played your part. You simply refused to see what was right before your eyes. It's not my fault you chose to keep telling yourself lies. You're telling me you're telling people I'm a witch, and yes, that may be true. But when it comes to smoke and mirrors, the reflection seen is you. You say that I play games no matter what the cost, but you played the same as me. You're just bitter that you lost. I really was quite honest when I told you of my plans, but you refused to hear the truth. 'Tis pride that falls the man. End poem.
Great reading. Let me see. I can walk this in the world of her herself, the idea of laying out that which she puts in her stories and the fact that you don't see anything with it until it's explained in the end. It's kind of a notation to a good writer, or your lack of actual vision in the moment, because she hits with that. You simply refuse to see what was right before your eyes. That careful little notes upon page 20, or the obvious one that's staring you in the face on 55. Yet those little clues are laid out in a pattern that you're supposed to pick up and gravitate to, because they're supposed to stick out in the mind. Yes, that notation hits on the back end. I really was quite honest when I told you of my plans, but you refused to hear the truth. 'Tis pride that falls the man. The idea of thinking that you're smart enough to outsmart the opponent instead of paying attention to that which is actually going on within the game that you're both playing. And the idea being, hey, you know what? When you play a game, there's a winner, there's a loser, there's consequences. And whether it's the thief, the boogeyman, or the criminal against whoever, the cop, most often times, all times within this venue, it comes out as the bad guy always loses.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rex, for the awesome comment. I really appreciate it. And by the way, great show tonight.
Yep. It was a bit different, but I get the gist of it. I've always watched this story. Hercule Poirot, Miss Marple and company.
What's that?
Hercule Poirot, Miss Marple and company. So always been a lot of fun with those, especially the adaptation into the movies.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, I have to agree.
Mm-hmm.
So
he's been in, what, 30-odd books, a ton of movies, and like 50 short stories in Hercule Poirot. And
yeah,
been played over the years by a bunch of people. You look at, David Suchet did him on television. They did every one of their stories over the number of seasons that ran on BBC. You've got a bunch of Albert Finney played him, Peter Ustinov, and some other people as well over the years in television and screen movies. So Agatha had lived long past her day in the sun.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like those shows that are based on her books, you know, like that are on the BBC. Good stuff. Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Any upcoming contests or shows that you'd like to mention?
Greg Brown for Friday, or Friday for Sunday. Got a rhythm and rhyme. Check it out. There's got 5 in there now, so there's still plenty of time and plenty of room. What about Friday morning? What about Break On Through?
Oh, Break On Through, yes. For Break On Through, I'm running a contest with the artwork of, what artwork am I doing? Well, it's a Mexican artist because it's Cinco de Mayo. And you know what? I am really sorry. I'm forgetting his name, and I'm a little slow at getting the page opened up. Ah, yes, here we go. It is the art of Jose Guadalupe Posada. So make sure to check out that contest and check out all the contests from the Late Night Poets hosts and hostesses, because you're sure to find something to inspire.
All right. Well, good night, everybody. We'll do this again next Tuesday. And come check us out during the rest of the week. I'll be on Sunday and Friday morning and Friday evening co-chairing. So come on back. We'll do some more. Good night, everybody.